Dave Fleming and Sarah Connolly with Andrew Davis in the pit. Opera on Three, tonight at 6 o'clock.
Well, this is BBC Radio 3 on 90 to 93 FM, digital radio and online. 1 o'clock's the time. Time for the news from Ian Skelly.
A war of words has erupted between David Cameron and Nick Clegg about how internships are handed out. The Prime Minister has said he's very relaxed about giving placements to family friends, apparently contradicting earlier comments by his deputy. This morning, Mr Clegg insisted that he's not relaxed at all about the idea of informal internships arranged through contacts. Reports from Syria suggest that security forces have shot dead at least three people attending the funerals of anti-government protesters who were killed at rallies across the country yesterday. More than 75 people died yesterday, the deadliest day of the uprising against President Bashar al-Assad. Strathclyde police have raided the homes of people suspected of making hateful comments about figures involved in Scottish football. In recent weeks, mail bombs have been sent to the Celtic manager Neil Lennon, and a number of youth players have been disciplined for posts they've made on social networking websites. The biggest teaching union, the NUT, is expected to call for a strike ballot over pensions this afternoon. Members are meeting in Harrogate for their annual conference. The creator of Only Fools and Horses, John Sullivan, has died after a short illness. He was 64. The BBC Director General, Mark Thompson, said he had a unique gift for turning everyday life and characters into unforgettable comedy. His most recent work, Rock and Chips, is scheduled to be shown on BBC One this Thursday. St James's Palace has released more details of the guest list for next week's royal wedding. Nearly 50 international royals, relatives of soldiers killed in Iraq and Afghanistan, and celebrities including Sir Elton John will be attending. And the weather, a dry and sunny afternoon in most parts. There'll be some heavy rain in Scotland, though, with some showers in London and the northeast of England later. Temperatures will be in the 20s across most of England, peaking at 26 degrees Celsius in the south-east. Wales will reach 16, but Scotland and Northern Ireland won't get above 12. And that's the BBC News and the weather. It's 2 minutes past one.
And time for the Early Music Show with Catherine Bott.
Today's programme is a little bit different. With the help of the Dean of St Paul's Cathedral, Graham Knowles, Rabbi Y.Y. Rubenstein, Cambridge scholar Kim Phillips and actor James Quinn, I'm going to explore the poetry and theology of one of the most desolate books in the Old Testament, Lamentations. Still an integral part of the Jewish faith and a vital element in the Christian liturgy of Holy Week, these sorrowful poems attributed to the prophet Jeremiah have inspired many composers to write breath-catchingly beautiful and mournful music. We're going to discover the history of Lamentations, explore the structure of the original Hebrew texts, and hear them translated into Latin in music spanning four centuries by European composers Brumel, Lassus, Heineken, Palestrina, and Zelenka. Let's begin our lament in England with this set of Lamentations by Thomas Tallis.
Echo Yoshua Bedod, Ho'ir Rabosi Om, Hoyasoka Almano,
How deserted lies the city, once so full of people. How like a widow is she, who once was great among the nations. She who was queen among the provinces has now become a slave. Bitterly she weeps at night. Tears are upon her cheeks. Among all her lovers, there is none to comfort her. All her friends have betrayed her. They have become her enemies. After affliction and harsh labor, Judah has gone into exile. She dwells among the nations. She finds no resting place. All who pursue her have overtaken her in the midst of her distress.
Thank you.
the first set of Lamentations by Thomas Tallis, sung by the Tallis Scholars, directed by Peter Phillips. That music sets Latin texts for the Catholic liturgy of Holy Week, but what of the original Hebrew message of Lamentations? Here's Rabbi Y.Y. Rubinstein.
The Book of Lamentations was written by the prophet Jeremiah, and Jeremiah spent no less than 40 years trying to warn the Jewish people that their behaviour was seen by God as being unacceptable. And the consequences were that they were going to lose everything, lose their country, lose their peoplehood and be taken into exile. He was probably the most unpopular prophet in the whole of history because nobody likes to be told bad news. I saw written somewhere once that no country, no nation can fall from external threat until it's destroyed from internal threat. And sometimes people loses confidence in who they are and what they are, and they fail to believe in themselves anymore. And when that happens, then, of course, they lose their greatest defence, and that's when they become vulnerable to external attack. So the prophet Jeremiah wrote these lamentations as an appeal to the people of the land of Israel to realise that if their behaviour didn't change, then everything would change, and the people of Israel would no longer be the people in Israel, and they'd be taken into exile in Babylonia. This was profoundly unpopular. He was imprisoned for his message, but of course his message was tragically accurate. And not only did they lose the temple, it was a war. I mean, hundreds of thousands of people were slaughtered when Jerusalem fell and when the temple was destroyed 2,500 years ago. However, the resonance echoes annually in the Jewish calendar. There is a day which commemorates the destruction of the first temple and the second temple, which incidentally wasn't the exact same day. And this day of misfortune echoes through the centuries when the Jews were exiled from medieval England on the same day. And so it's a day of great sadness. And this is why these terribly evocative lamentations reappear with the same message year after year. If you don't reconnect with God, if you don't reconnect with who and what your true essence is, then indeed you face the same threat and the same fate as an ongoing prediction, an ongoing lamentation.
How the Lord has covered the daughter of Zion with the cloud of his anger. He has hurled down the splendor of Israel from heaven to earth. He has not remembered his footstool in the day of his anger. Without pity, the Lord has swallowed up all the dwellings of Jacob. In his wrath, he has torn down the strongholds of the daughter of Judah. He has brought her kingdom and its princes down to the ground in dishonor.
Peter Phillips conducted the Talis Scholars in that setting of the Lamentations by the 15th century French composer Antoine Brumel. As I mentioned earlier, although we're hearing these texts in Latin translation today, the poems were originally written in Hebrew. There's been a great deal of speculation about who may actually have written them. We asked Kim Phillips, a Cambridge University Bible scholar, about current thinking on the authorship of the Lamentations.
The one thing that most people would be fairly sure of is that they're probably not by Jeremiah. Not even sure, really, whether there are 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5 poets. So we know very, very little. It looks as though it's probably by somebody or people in the city itself, just because the imagery itself is so stark and so raw that it would be hard to imagine it coming from somebody who was at a distance, as it were. But beyond that, we don't know.
The chapters of the Book of Lamentations are constructed with each verse starting with the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet. So the first verse starts off with an aleph, that's the A, and says Echo, how, questions, how could this have happened, this fate befallen the Jewish people. The next verse, an acrostic, is the B, the base of the Hebrew. And so each verse follows each letter of the Hebrew alphabet. Now this isn't just a trick. There is great symbolism in Judaism of the A, B, C, the Aleph, Beis, Gimel, through to the final letter of the Hebrew alphabet, Tav, because it has a resonance of completion and entirety. And the idea is that the Jewish people failed in their entirety. All of the Jewish ideas of the Torah, all the mission of the Jewish people, from beginning to end, from Aleph to Tav, we comprehensively failed in. And that's the message, really, that he repeats again, because each of the chapters repeats this structure.
Chapter 1 is the city is portrayed as a woman who's wailing, as lost her husband. Chapter 2 is far more violent. It's the city being destroyed by God himself. So God, who used to fight for Israel and Judah, is now fighting against them. Chapter 3 is a far more reflective chapter, and the imagery changes to this man, individual man, who's suffering affliction, with obvious links to Jeremiah and maybe even to the suffering servant in Isaiah. And then chapter 4 goes back to a sort of physical portrayal of the city, and the imagery is of a city that's been under siege for a long time, and so what you're seeing is the devastation and the decimation. The meter, or the rhythm, which is a bit of a difficult issue in Hebrew poetry, is what they call a kinah meter. Roughly a 3-beat followed by 2-beat pattern, which some people say gives it more of a limping style. And some people would want to see that 3-2 meter as a sort of bridge for the whole Book of Lamentations. So you've got chapters 1, 2 and 3, and then a separate sort of pause, because chapter 3 is really the culmination, and then 4 and 5 limping off towards the end in the same way that the 3-2 meter limps off. Lots of people would think that chapter 5 was written later, respectively, than the other chapters, because it seems to represent, or it seems to portray a picture of people who have been suffering for an extended period of time, really at their wit's end by this point.
Thank you.
Lamentationes Jeremiae Prophetae, Lamentations of the Prophet Jeremiah, set in the mid-16th century by the Franco-Flemish Orlandus Lassus, sung by Ensemble Vocal Orlando. You're listening to The Early Music Show with me, Catherine Bott, and today's programme is focusing solely on the Lamentations, with settings by composers spanning four centuries. As we've heard from Rabbi Y.Y. Rubinstein and Kim Phillips, the original Hebrew texts found in the Torah still play an important part in the Jewish faith, but Christianity adopted these dark and sorrowful words from the Old Testament for use at Passiontide. The Dean of St. Paul's Cathedral, Graham Knowles.
As far as the texts are concerned, yes, they run through the Holy Week period, the Great Week, as it was called, leading up to Good Friday, Holy Saturday, and Easter Day itself. And they're mood-setting pieces. They capture the atmosphere that the liturgy was trying to create, the atmosphere of utter devastation on Good Friday. The great thing about the Holy Week services is that they are a great dramatic piece. They start with Palm Sunday, with the entry into Jerusalem, the crowd going wild. Jesus is it. He's riding in on a donkey. He's the king. They shout Hosanna. But it's the same group of people who are shouting crucify him a few days later. And Jeremiah's pieces from the Lamentations actually catch up that so well. The quick change of atmosphere from jubilation at the beginning of the week to utter devastation at the end of the week. Part of the business of Holy Week is that you should really follow it all the way through, capturing each part. Maundy, Thursday, the Last Supper, Good Friday, the death. Holy Saturday, nothing. Just waiting to see what happens, and then dawn and resurrection. Et multitudinem servitutis habitavit inter gentes, nec infinit requiem, nec infinit requiem. Omnes persecutores eius apprehendunt eam inter angustias. Amen.
Tenor Peter Schreier with an 18th century German setting of the Lamentations by Johann Heinichen. The musicians of Virtuosi Saxoniae were conducted by Ludwig Güttler. What is it about these poems that makes them so apt for setting to music? Graham Knowles again.
I think when you look at the composers who have set the Lamentations of Jeremiah, many of them have also set the great poem Stabat Mater, which is, again, a piece of poetry to do with Holy Week, Mary standing by the cross of Jesus. And for a lot of those early composers, the liturgy itself didn't offer a great deal in the way of drama. So they had to edge it a bit outside to find those texts which allowed them to word paint in a rather more dramatic way than they would otherwise have done with just setting the Mass or the particular texts which fall to the services during Holy Week. And the Lamentations, the Stabat Mater, actually just pick that up so spectacularly. Some of the poetry isn't very good, so that's what the good thing about the good thing about the Lamentations is, it is good poetry as well.
Remember, O Lord, what has happened to us. Look and see our disgrace. Our inheritance has been handed to strangers, our houses to foreigners. We're like orphans, without a father. Our mothers are like widows. We are led away, our necks under the yoke. We are weary, yet find no rest.
Thank you.
the Talis scholars again with Palestrina's Lamentations for Holy Saturday. Before we hear the last music in today's programme, some final words from Graham Knowles, Dean of St Paul's Cathedral, and first, Rabbi Y.Y. Rubinstein, about contemporary attitudes to the message contained in the Lamentations for both Christian and Jewish faiths.
Even today, when Jewish people go to Jerusalem, of course, everybody's heard of the Wailing Wall. That's the last remaining wall of the Second Temple, built by King Herod, who was a very controversial character in Jewish history, rather, frankly, a nasty piece of work, still managed to achieve some beautiful architecture and some building. When the temple was destroyed, all the pieces of the temple were taken and exported to build other buildings in other parts of the Roman Empire. This is the last remaining monument or element of the temple, and the bit that you see extends about the same height underground, and they've excavated. You can walk deeply into the depths of the earth and see the beauty of the stones, which have not been weathered through the last 2,000 years, and see how stunning it is. But it's not a question of architecture or of stones. It's the fact that there is no temple there. And the fact, from Judaism's point of view, that there is no temple there stands as a finger pointing at the Jewish people that still we are doing the same things to a certain degree that made us lose the temple in the first place. The lack of a temple there is a statement that Jewish people, you still have a lot more to do in your mission to recover the essential and inevitable endorsement that comes from heaven and is symbolised by the presence of a temple that once you had and a second time you had, and Jews pine and hope one day to have recovered their relationship with God sufficiently to have again.
They're about a people who are looking at something that was their pride and is now their devastation. But they're also looking at a God who they know actually does love them, and they're trying to find their way back to that God so that a relationship can be restored. So in the Lamentations of Jeremiah, there is that sense of devastation and of loss, but there's also a huge sense of longing for something to be right again, to be put back in order again. So the great cry that comes, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, return unto the Lord thy God, is a sense that of longing that somehow that man and God have to get their act back together again.
Of the Lamentations for Easter Eve by Jan Dismas Zelenka, sung there by the tenor John Mark Ainsley with the Shandos Baroque Players. That brings to an end today's Early Music Show, which was presented by Catherine Bott and produced in Manchester by Les Pratt. Well, in tomorrow's programme, Lucy Skeeping will be looking at an oratorio which Handel wrote for Easter Sunday in Rome in 1708. That's at the usual time, just after the 1 o'clock news.
Free your imagination. Books on the BBC.
On Thursday night, BBC Television explores the career of the writer Frank L. Baum and the true story behind his most famous creation.
It's no exaggeration to say that Oz and Oz books were the Harry Potter of their day.
Finding out how this modern-day fairy tale reflects the life and times of its author.
When producers paid his family for the rights to The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, they were buying into Frank Baum's philosophy of life.
The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, the true story. Thursday night at 9 on BBC Four.
Well, just looking ahead to the coming week and composer of the week, Donald MacLeod will be telling the story of one of our most celebrated composers, Gustav Holst, a man who was deeply suspicious of his own celebrity. And the series features many of Holst's works for the stage, including his ballets and complete performances of several rarely heard operas. Holst's poor health kept him from active service during most of the Great War, and stuck at home as he was, he composed the work that would make him world famous, The Planets, which would actually haunt him for the rest of his life. In Tuesday's programme, we'll hear two movements from The Planets in a version for two pianos. So that's Composer of the Week, Gustav Holst, at midday until 1 o'clock each day, and then again in the evening from 10 o'clock until 11 o'clock. Well, this is BBC Radio 3. It's 2 o'clock. We have another chance now to hear a concert given in London's Wigmore Hall last Monday lunchtime. It's presented by Sean Rafferty.
Good afternoon and welcome to Wigmore Hall for a recital by one of the supreme masters of his instrument. Self-effacing wisdom and skill which brought the house down, as Ivy has described at a recent concert by the New York Times. The great Pablo Casals invited him to master classes in the 1960s after he'd won the international cello competition that bore his name. Today, Miklós Perényi, professor at the Franz Liszt Academy in Budapest and simply one of the greatest cellists in the world, plays Bach and Britten. Bach appropriately to begin, it was Casals, fascinated by his unaccompanied suites from the age of 13, who brought them into the limelight of concert performance as masterpieces. Even Schumann, who thought them the most beautiful and significant ever written, felt compelled to write a piano accompaniment for them. Rostropovich called the last of these suites a symphony for solo cello, and the sixth, in the joyous key of D, is the most polyphonic and maybe enigmatic of them all, a culmination of all that went before, rich, subtle, and very demanding. Only the best can bring out the burnished, complex mystery, especially as Bach also called for an extra string in his suite, an extra E above the normal A. Possibly the instrument he had in mind, the wonderfully upheld Viola Pomposo, a five-string instrument invented in the 1720s, and it didn't linger along very long, or maybe for a five-stringed violoncello piccolo, which he certainly used in some of his cantatas. There are five movements in all, a prelude, and then we dance our way through an allemande, courante, sarabande, two gavottes, and a final gig. A dance suite that transcends any earthly attempt to anchor it in words. And here to play the suite for cello number 6 in D major by Bach, Miklós Perényi.
Thank you. Thank you.